Good afternoon, everyone. We are so glad to be here with you for this very first Answers in Energy Speaker Series. We have two great speakers today, Governor David Walters and Lee Payden. As you know, the Energy and Answers Speaker Series is dedicated to addressing issues of energy, natural resources, and environmental law and policy here in the United States and worldwide. Answers in Energy is a part of the University of Tulsa Law School and particularly our Master of Jurisprudence in Energy Law program. It is a degree program open to lawyers and non-lawyers alike who need specialized education in energy, natural resources, and environmental law to further their goals, their lives, and their careers. The Answers in Energy Speaker Series is, in fact, a part of one of our formal classes for the Master of Jurisprudence in Energy Law. For those of you attending this series live, you are in the University of Tulsa College of Law's online classroom. And I have with me Rick Munoz. Rick is the professor of the Energy Laboratory class, and together Rick and I will interview our guests.
Thank you, Jason. The goal of this class is for both of our distinguished speakers to provide issues and information on things that the students can use to develop a thesis proposal on. So we're very excited for the both of you to be here, and we think the students will definitely benefit from your knowledge.
So with all of that as kind of prefatory information, please allow me just one more minute to offer a formal introduction to our two distinguished guests. The Honorable David Lee Walters was the 24th governor of Oklahoma from 1991 to 1995. Born near Canute, Oklahoma, Mr. Walters graduated as valedictorian from Canute High School. He earned a bachelor's degree in industrial engineering from the University of Oklahoma and a master's degree in business administration from Harvard University. Governor Walters' first passion was healthcare. He was a project manager for former Governor David L. Boren at the age of 29, and he then became the youngest executive officer in the University of Oklahoma's history. Later, Walters joined the Berks Group, a commercial and real estate company, and shortly after that, he was appointed by then-Governor Nye as the co-chairman of the governor's 100-member reform commission. Later, Governor Walters became president of the American Fidelity and Property Company. On November 6, 1990, Governor Walters was elected the governor of Oklahoma, carrying 75 of the 77 counties here in our state, a sweep. During his term, education funding increased by approximately 30%, and a $350 million bond issue for higher education brought construction and renovation to every state college campus here. Governor also continued to follow through on increasing health care in Oklahoma. And more recently, Governor Walters has managed the development of energy, particularly electric generation, in installations throughout the world. The governor pioneered a number of important innovations in energy development and is today blazing new ground in Texas with electric generation there using both more traditional technologies as well as newer and renewable technologies. It is about these important energy development efforts that Governor Walters is and has undertaken that we'll focus today. We're also honored and thrilled to have Governor Walters with us as our inaugural speaker. As you can see from Governor Walters' background, everything that he undertakes becomes a success. And we feel confident that the same recipe holds true for us today, that the Answers in Energy Speaker Series is off to a successful start because we have you here today to help us begin it. So, Governor, thank you for making the time to be with us.
Thank you, Jason. Very flattering introduction. I'll correct it as we go along.
Well, more than just those mistakes, we are absolutely honored to have with us Lee Payden. Lee Payden is a well-known and influential lawyer here in Oklahoma. For more than three decades, Lee represented the Public Service Company of Oklahoma in probably all aspects of the operation of a utility company. Lee's substantial matters have included working on the merger of PSO with various other entities, including Central and Southwest, and more recently with the American Electric Power Corporation. In what Lee describes as his retirement, others would call it a second career. Lee has represented numerous entities before the Oklahoma Corporation Commission, and Lee is currently working on issues relating to renewable energy development here in Oklahoma. Lee, thank you for making time to be here with us today, too.
Jason, you're welcome. I feel something similar to a waffle who's had the syrup poured all over him, but I appreciate the opportunity to participate today.
Well, Lee, you've never reminded me of a waffle before, and I've known you for almost 20 years. So thanks for being here. Well, let's get started. And let's get started, I guess, where every good story starts, and that's at the beginning. Governor, as I understood it in from my research, in your career, you started out interested in healthcare. How did that transition to energy?
Well, I had I initially started when I graduated in industrial engineering. I was offered an opportunity to join the administration at the University of Oklahoma, and I did just that. I was in administration and finance, working for a lot of great people. Dean of engineering took over administration and finance back then, a fellow by the name of Gene Nordby. And so it was. Those were heady days then. We were building everything, the new law school, the Nobel Arena, all that stuff. And so I was involved in that development. I went off to get a graduate degree at Harvard. I came back and went to work for the University of Oklahoma Health Sciences Center as associate provost there, and so, which was a little unusual not to have a medical background in that number two position at the Health Sciences Center. But again, we were building a lot, and that campus was growing and booming, and it was a major medical center in the region. And so it was a wonderful 5 years that I spent there, and then I went on into private business. But my healthcare interest and knowledge, if you will, emanated out of the time I spent at the University of Oklahoma Health Sciences Center.
Sure. And then so after your time there at the Health Sciences Center, you went on into real estate activities and then ultimately took on public service.
I did. We, you know, again, the timing was both great and bad, but I went into the real estate business out of the Health Sciences Center back in the boom days. So everybody, I noticed all friends who I was convinced were not as smart as me flying their own airplanes and having expensive vacations. And so I went into the business with Ron Burks, and we were building at that time, we were renovating the Skirvin Hotel and doing a bunch of hotels, doing office buildings. We built what was then known as the Penn Square Bank building, if that's any prelude to what ultimately happened. But then we went through the bust, and that was equally challenging, and you learn a lot from that. And so we survived the bust in real estate. And in that process, I helped C.W. Cameron, who is the founder of American Fidelity, create a real estate company within their confines. And I ran that for a while. And from there, I decided to run for governor. You know, it was like the movie Network, where things weren't going well. The state's budget was struggling. And it was like hanging your head out the window and saying, I'm not going to take it anymore. By golly, I can do that job. And so, how old was I? I would have been 34. And so at 34, I was so presumptuous and naive that I thought I could run the state. I was almost elected. Thank God Henry Bellman beat me by a percentage point. But I came back and ran again and was elected, as you said, by a large margin in 1990.
Well, that's neat. After you'd left public service, you've been so successful in energy development around the world. How did that transition occur?
You know, I've always been a builder, developer, kind of project-oriented person. So I had a bit of a blank slate leaving office, and the most interesting offer that I had was from Don Smith, who had a company called Smith Cogeneration. It was one of the very early IPPs, independent power producers, that was sanctioned. And so he had built a cogeneration plant in Oklahoma City, again, after a huge fight with the utility, and had done well with that. And Don was quite interested in international development, so he had me come in. I think I had the title of president of Smith Cogeneration International, and immediately was thrown into projects in Pakistan, because the World Bank had just announced a really generous support for Pakistan, who had a huge, or doesn't look huge anymore, but it was a 3,000 megawatt deficit in their energy supply. And so the World Bank organized a wonderful process to invite folks to come in and make bids, and it was very systematic and well done. I haven't seen a process that well done since then, frankly. And sure enough, it generated 3,000 megawatts of additional generation for Pakistan. We were in the middle of that. We went through all through the process. We actually got awarded a project. We never did consummate the project for lots of different reasons, but I made lots of contacts in Pakistan, lots of friends, and ultimately came back to Pakistan and did business after I set up my own company.
Well, tell us a little bit about that, doing some business in Pakistan. What was it like?
Well, it's not for the faint of heart, and you have to be fatalistic. You know, you have to not believe that somebody's going to jump out and grab you. But it's a pretty good microcosm for developing or trying to build complicated, expensive infrastructure projects in developing nations. They don't have the resources to do it. Most of what's already there is owned by the government. Is very inefficient and beaten up, and so they reached out to try to find a different way to do this. And we had been trading equipment in and out of there for a while, meaning that we were buying we'd buy power plants and dismantle them and then resell them. And so we had sold a sizable amount of equipment in Pakistan. I still had these contacts from my early 90 years. And I guess in the early 2000s, where it really picked up is General Musharraf was in charge, and he was desperate. He had been in power for 7 years, and they'd not added a kilowatt of generation. And so I wound up in a meeting with him in Islamabad, in which he said, everybody wants, 2 years to build a power plant. And I said, well, building a power plant's no big deal. We can build you one in 6 months, but getting paid for it's the issue. And he said, what do you want? And I told him what I wanted, and which was essentially a letter of credit for the – I said, we'll build it and own it and operate it, but I need a letter of credit ensuring I get paid, confirmed in a U.S. bank. And he said, I'll do that. Well, everybody in the room just fainted because and GE later told me they changed their turbine forecast based on that meeting because it was so unusual a financial mechanism for the leader of a country that is that big. You know, Pakistan's half the size, more than half the size of the U.S. Yeah. in population. And so for our leader of the country to make that kind of financial commitment, and all of a sudden there was something called the rental power program that sprang up, and they started building thousands of megawatts. And we built we were one of the first two plants to do this. GE came in immediately and tried to steal the project from us, of course. That's what big companies do to little companies. Eventually the Pakistan said, what are we doing? We'll let them both build a plant. So we both built plants outside of Lahore, Pakistan. And then we ultimately built a second plant, and we're building a third when the wheels kind of came off the wagon in Pakistan. I talked for a year on Pakistan, but it was just an important lesson that they had a reasonably good legal system. They've got a relatively free press, a relatively democratic society. But at the end of the day, the Chief Justice took over the country, and he turned out to be irrational, I would say. So he declared all RPP contracts void ab initio. Since I'm in a law school program, I can say that and not have to explain it too much. But he voided all the contracts over the last 5 or 6 years. Plants started shutting down. They now have a terrible power crisis, worse than when I first started working in the arena in 1995. And they're really suffering, and it's adding to the turmoil and difficulties that are there, and the U.S. government's pulling their hair out. And so it's a real mess now, worse than it was in the early 90s.
Governor Walters, I'd like to follow up. If a student was interested in doing a thesis paper on infrastructure development in a country like Pakistan, I think that you've hit on a couple of issues that I think might be relevant to them in terms of contract law and mm-hmm. things of that nature. Could you elaborate a little bit on what it might be that they could focus on infrastructure development?
Yeah, well, it'd be all of that. I mean, how do you do it? How do you make it happen? And getting paid, as I told General Musharraf, we can build a power plant, no big deal. This isn't rocket science, unless you're building nuclear. But it's relatively easy. Getting paid is the whole thing. And so, how do you get? Are their financial commitments any good? Typically not. And so how do you get a legitimate financial commitment? That's normally going to be a letter of credit. It can't be confirmed by banks they control, so you got to get offshore. money can't be kept in the country because the banking system, again, and you know, you have to, in worst case, they can take your money. So you have to have banks in London or elsewhere act as the repository banks. And so there's just a whole series of elements that you would do to protect. You know, if you're spending, you know, a few thousand dollars, maybe not, but if you're spending $100 million or $200 million, you're going to have all those protections in place. And then really excellent attorneys. You know, we've worked with some of the best, I think, around the world to protect you. And what you don't anticipate is the collapse of the legal system at the top. You know, so you always have an appeal process. But what was unusual in Pakistan was a judicial coup. I think I may have coined that term. I wrote a piece for Foreign Policy magazine. The judicial coup occurs. And so from the very top of that, well, then, thank goodness, we had London-based arbitration, and so we gear up the arbitration process. But checkmate, they just decide they're going to arrest our local partners if we pursue the arbitration. So. So I don't know how you do a thesis on that, but I guess it could be a cascading series of mitigations. Ending in the fact that when they decide to take your personal liberty, that's pretty much out the door. But hopefully I don't think Pakistan is going to do that again. I think we told them, everybody told them, your foreign direct investment is going to go to zero. It went to zero. They are just in a massive mess at the moment. And so
that's, thank you. And I would just like to add for students who are listening in on what Governor Walters just talked about there, I think there's a rich number of topics that you could really focus in terms of thinking about a thesis on the several things that he had talked about. So.
Well, Rick, if I could follow up, I'm kind of curious. It's not something that we necessarily chatted about earlier, Governor, but and you may not want to say, but what you think. But what do you think the outlook is for energy and other investment in Pakistan or places like Pakistan in the near future?
Well, until Pakistan demonstrates that they will return to the rule of law and that contracts mean something. You know, China always had this rap in the early years. China was contracts to them, and literally in their culture, just meant something different. Typically, it was just a snapshot in time. It was like a football play before the ball was snapped. You know, it's kind of where here's the lay of the land. So China was always a very difficult. I went to China 5, 6, 7 times, chased a number of projects, but we couldn't get to the contract. So Pakistan was a welcome relief because we had it. But once they're going to have to demonstrate that they will go back to that and it has to be sustained, or it's all going to be, you know, USAID or China, or every day if you read the papers in Pakistan, which we do, thank goodness for Google Alerts, you see that, well, today it's Romania is going to help them and tomorrow it's China and then it's France, and well, nobody's going to step in until they demonstrate there's not enough governmental money to build the kind of infrastructure they need for 175 million people. And so they're going to have to demonstrate, and it'll take 10 years, you know, for them to be able to get a GE or even a small company like ours to step up and take the risk of that happening again. So what that Chief Justice did was unbelievable, really.
Set the nation back a decade or more.
It's amazing. And so it's a fragile system when you get down to it, when you've got foreign investment that is depending on those what turns out to be very tenuous kind of protections. You know, we thought we were, you know, LCs and offshore and this, that, and the other, and had it all covered. But when they void the contract, and Turkey, if you Google this, Turkey's got two huge barges that they can't get out of the country, brand new power generation barges. And Turkey's, again, in the news every day, there's announced a new Turkish company is looking at making investments in Pakistan. Well, that's just negotiating fodder. That's not real. Nobody in Turkey's going to put a dime in Pakistan until they sort this out.
Until somebody commits to actually paying for it.
Yeah. So on to Bangladesh.
yes. And one thing I would like to mention to the students out there, for as Governor Walters has mentioned again, is that the importance of the stability of contract law and how it relates to resource development, and that's something you might want to think about focusing on your thesis on.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we've mentioned a couple of technical terms as we've gotten started, and I thought it might be helpful, and this also might be a place where we can drag Lee into the conversation. Governor, you'd mentioned a term called, IPP. And I know what an IPP is, an independent power producer. But, these concepts are universal, really, in Pakistan or in wherever you go. Here in the United States, we have IPPs. I was wondering if I can get you guys, as two of the real experts in the world on what IPPs are and how IPPs work, to kind of describe that for everyone.
Well, an independent power producer is an entity that really came out of an act of Congress that authorized the creation of what are called electric wholesale generators. And before those existed, virtually all of the generation was owned by public utilities or owned by municipal utilities across the United States. IPPs were invented, if you will, because the big utilities had literally stopped building generation. The advent of Three Mile Island the downslope of building nuclear plants in the United States, the enactment of the Fuel Use Act and some other things back in the 70s, the utility business decided that they were only going to build plants when they absolutely were required to by a regulatory authority. And so the Congress stepped in and said, okay, well, let's give independents the opportunity to do that. And from the period of about 1994, 95, 96, until about the end of the first decade of the 21st century, thousands of megawatts of new generation were created by independent entities. And it took up the slack that existed and got to a point where there really was a need for additional power, and it became – the opportunity became less to build even on an independent basis. That's beginning to turn around a little bit now with the advent of coal being attacked by environmental sources and coal plants being subject to retirement. And some are being shut down by regulatory kinds of activities. We just saw in the last week that the federal courts approved the closing of one coal plant in 2016 and another in 2026 in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. That will begin to put a stress on the system. But having said all that, independent wind and solar have stepped in as another form, although they're not technically IPPs, as another form of electric energy generation. And so those activities are helping to span the difference between what's going to be shut down from coal provide enough energy to allow us to get through another set of crises, if you will.
Right on. Well, thanks, Lee. That was really helpful. Thinking about these issues and kind of coming back to the questions in places like Pakistan and the developing world, you know, Lee, you were mentioning coal being retired here in the U.S., and the obvious reasons for retiring coal are to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and also some local pollution issues. Governor, I wanted to ask you, in these developing countries where there's a need to put in electric generation where there is none, where people read by the light of a kerosene lamp and not by the light of a light bulb, what sort of energy technologies ought to be developed there?
Well, whatever will generate a kilowatt hour initially And one of my pet peeves, kind of a funny story. We were doing some business with the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. We had developed a LNG import station that those things have gotten a lot simpler. So for $150 million, they used to cost $1 billion, but you can put these things in now. And as we were working on that, we got from the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, which is the U.S. government's kind of private development bank, if you will, supported by taxpayers, we got a $100 million note. And so we developed this big relationship with them. And so they came to us. This was in Pakistan. They came to us and said, hey, we've got to have somebody build some wind power. We're under pressure from the Congress to do more environmental stuff. And obviously we want to do it anyway. And I said, are you crazy? They're, you know, they've got a 25,000 megawatt demand. There's 15,000 megawatts wind, solar, all that's going to be much more expensive. It's not going to generate much. It's intermittent. You know, you need to do whatever you possibly can. And they said, well, we'll finance it. We'll provide the debt for it. And I said, well, that's still, who's going to put equity into a renewable project in the middle of the Sin Desert, you know, when you can do natural gas and, you know, for a fraction of the cost? And they said, well, we'll get you a grant from the USAID, so we'll cover both the equity and the debt. And at that point, I said, I've always wanted to do wind power in Pakistan. So, again, how do you get it paid for? How do you get it financed? So it takes that kind of, a government deciding we're going to build it for it to make economic sense in a heart. Now, it sounds like I'm anti-renewable. Far from it. Encourage it. But the societies that need to be pushing that are the societies like ours that have an overabundance of it. When you have no energy, the idea of talking about not wasting energy seems to be kind of silly. I mean, how do you turn the air conditioning down in these buildings that don't have any? How do you save power? And then secondly, the distraction of trying to force them into renewables before they can get their feet off the ground with sources of power that cost one-tenth of what it takes to put in place. Let's just get started. Let's try to keep the lights on. And then when we advance to the point of having an abundance like we do, or not even us, but once they get to the point of where they can keep the lights on, then, yeah, let's start trying to blend in some renewable generation.
But just to augment that, one of the things that you have to have, you can build a generator and do it fairly simply, as the governor said, 6 months to build one. But you've also got to have the other infrastructure. You've got to have the transmission. Mm-hmm. And then, as you said, people are reading by, you know, coal oil lantern. And the truth of the matter is you've got to have the distribution that gets it into the town or the city or the housing development or whatever it might be. So it's not simply building a generator. It's also having all of this other infrastructure that's either being built or already is in place to move it from the generator to the consumer.
And how do those things get built normally?
Well, I think part of the problem is infrastructure just isn't there, and that has to be a part of the planning process.
It is typically a governmental role, isn't it, in the development? I mean, I'm thinking back to the early days in our country with the Rural Electric Initiative.
Right.
And my grandfather, I've got a picture of him before he came to the United States. He was in Norway, and his first job was carrying electric cables over the mountains to the rural electrification effort in Norway.
Yeah, understanding your question, I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand. How do these get built? They get built with monopolies, and so you've got to guarantee somebody a monopoly when you're wanting to build an uneconomic line out on some remote reach, which is what Rural Electric basically was. How do you get that done? Well, you monopolize the system so that they have the financial resources to be able to extend the reach. And so, again, as we develop and as you get more sophisticated about distributed generation and more remote generation and individual generation, you know, I've got a wind turbine on a cabin on the Cimarron River. So then that becomes less important. But how do you get it initially built is that kind of monopoly.
And so I think for the students, one thing to think about is the legal framework that fosters that type of developmental model. That's something that would be rich in terms of investigating legal codes and models that have been used in different areas that foster that, and also to contrast those that don't.
Yeah. Yeah, really. What do you think is the maybe the greatest risk to the developing world being able to put together the kind of legal framework that's necessary to support that kind of infrastructure development through a monopolistic model?
Well, corruption is always the kind of the baseload. We have a very strong Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and so to the extent that there's governmental entities involved, and if they're not on the up and up, and frankly, I don't want to name the countries, but there's a number of countries around the world that every time the head of water and power decides to, they need a new chalet or something, they'll put out an RFP. They have no money, no capacity to do anything or to buy any more power. They just put out a request for proposal, and 100 companies will reply, and before you know it, he's got a new chalet. So, so I think corruption breeds a level of inefficiency in it. But that piece has really been, I think, pretty well studied. There's some great international studies about the actual cost of corruption to economies and how inefficient it becomes. The other is just best practices. It's amazing how many, you talk about the U.S. system. There's really 50 U.S. systems. There's a different system for every state. Well, then you, of course, have different systems in these countries and different regions of the countries. Northern England is different than Southern England in terms of how they handle it. So the ability to standardize, to make templates, to have, there's a reasonably standard independent power producer agreement, IPP, or power purchase agreement. Those documents are standardized, but the regulation piece of this is not standardized to any great degree, and not being righteous about it, it's very different from one state to another in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned England, and so far, we've talked a little bit about Pakistan and some of the more developing world. Let's talk a little bit about more of the developed world. You've worked in England, is that right?
Right, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your English experience.
Well, in the context of what I was just commenting on, the differences are very unique because England happens to be, of course, an island, and they have two relatively minor undersea cables, one to Ireland, one to France. That doesn't allow them to import enough power to meet their needs. So there's a case in which they're completely isolated, and capacity and to generate power and the demand for power is a real, very real thing. So in 2010, we wound up having a bunch of inventory in England. They had something called the Short-Term Operating Reserve Program called STORE. I had no idea what that was, but I had a guy over there, and he came back. He said, "I think we can build a small power plant and get paid for just sitting there." I said, "Great, let's do that." And so so we built what became the first purpose-built, because before that they had been just doing this with factories for their backup power facilities. We built the first purpose-built short-term operating reserve plant in England. I didn't know that at the time. I probably would have never taken that risk. But it started a niche industry. There was about 10 companies that immediately started doing the same thing. And today they've got a really strong reserve program. So and one of the other differences there, they're very committed to carbon emissions decline, very committed to wind generation, even solar, which makes no sense in England, of course, but very committed to renewables. And so that intermittency creates lots of instability on their grids. And so having a few thousand megawatts that you can fire off at a moment's notice, that may not be the cleanest, may not be the most efficient, but it's a cheap way to stabilize your grid, and it allows you to go do a lot of green generation. So we created a company called UK Power Reserve, and today is thriving in Birmingham and employs 30 or 40 people over there, and it's got 11 of these plants and building out more of those. But again, it was a characteristic that we stumbled into, recognized, and took advantage of. So we decided, let's go do this in Germany, France, elsewhere, where those markets are entirely different. They've got cross-border transmission. When they run out of power, they call on Sweden or somebody. I have no idea. But so we looked all over the world, and we found a market is slightly bigger than England that is equally isolated. They might as well be an island, and it's Texas, and they're running out of power. And so we're just delighted to now be in Texas doing what we were doing in England. But they, as a matter of regulatory policy, years ago, legal know a lot more about this than I do, they isolated themselves to avoid a certain amount of federal regulation. So, again, they have very little interconnection with the rest of the U.S. grid. And when they run out of power, lights flicker, and they're about to run out of power because they've deregulated no one's adding capacity there. And so we're down there now building reserve power plants, getting ready for the cliff, as we say.
And I think for the students, those of you who are interested in a case study, I think Texas might be a great example of how the legal framework or the public policy that a state or a government entity pursues has repercussions. And so it's very important to think about having a good legal framework that fosters long-term energy development.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about Texas. You say Texas is about to fall off an energy cliff, you think?
Well, the head of their Senate Energy Committee recently called in their local ISO, the Independent System Operators, called ERCOT. ERCOT is the Energy Reliability Council of Texas, and that's one of the eight independent system operators that operates all the electric system in the U.S. And they called them in and said, hey, your forecast indicate ERCOT does this. They hire a group called the Brattle Group. This is always fun to Google. But anyway, there's tons of information on the Internet about it. But they called in the Brattle Group, which said, hey, there's no way you guys, you're not adding capacity. Demand's growing. You're out of the recession, et cetera. You're going to go off the cliff in 2015. Well, the generators all showed up and said, well, we want a capacity market then. We want to be paid for capacity, which gives us the economic boost to go build more plants, and it would only cost the ratepayers down there $1 billion or $2 billion or some big number. All the industrial guys get organized and they go and complain to the legislature. They have a committee hearing. They bring ERCOT in. They said, you're going to redo that study, and the study's going to have, you know, you're going to give us some real numbers now. You know what I mean, Tex? You know, whatever. I have no idea what the conversation was, but lo and behold, there's a new Brattle study out that says they're not going over the cliff now until 2019. Well, 3 weeks ago, they hit their maximum power rate of $5,000 a megawatt hour, and they have, in order to be able to pull everybody into the market when they have a crisis, they've raised the rate. This summer, it'll be $7,000. For people listening, that's you're all paying 8 or 9 cents a kilowatt hour. That's if you're on an index rate, which means it's a floating rate. Most industries are down there. Well, then you'd be paying this summer $7 instead of 8 cents. And most of the industries
$7?
Are at 3 cents, yes, or so. You'd be paying $7 at the peak. Next summer it'll be $9 at the peak. And so they can push that cliff all the way out, but they hit the max about 3 weeks ago during some cold snap. I mean, it's, you know, you'd think their peak is going to be in the summer. Well, they keep having peaks in the winter because they have thermal issues with some plants, and plants come offline, et cetera. But that's how low that margin is in Texas between supply and demand, about 74,000 megawatts. And we went to England to try to keep the lights on for the Queen, and we're just trying to keep the lights on in Texas for old Rick Perry.
We here in Oklahoma are feeling smugly good about that.
Yeah.
That is really exceptionally interesting. We talked about a lot of things in relating to electric power generation and transmission in that context. And I know for you, Governor, and for you, Lee, going back through some of these issues is going to be a little bit mundane. But it also seems to me one of the really unique opportunities we have with this program is to be able to help our community understand what electric power really is and how the light bulbs turn on. Because it's not just as simple as flipping a switch. In fact, it's one of the most complicated and sophisticated industries in the entire world. And it's replicated, as you pointed out, Governor, in many, many different ways around the world. So let's just kind of go back through this question. You'd started out by indicating that in Texas there's more and more renewables, and that leads to fluctuations. And could you, one of you, both of you, kind of talk to about how renewables cause a fluctuation in the amount of the supply of electricity that's available?
I'll comment in terms of the intermittency. Of course, wind doesn't blow all the time, so if you've got several thousand megawatts, tens of thousands of megawatts on your system, it'll come on and run like crazy when the wind's blowing, and wind may be blowing at night or during the day, you just don't know. And all of a sudden that comes off. Now, it doesn't come off instantaneously. It bleeds down, it bleeds up, so you can forecast it. And we spent time at the National Grid in England watching these guys, you know, watch every piece of data they can find. And there's a famous little clip. It's called the teapot peak, that they try to take care of the peaks as things were fluctuating back and forth. And it turns out that in England, when they're watching their favorite TV shows and they go to commercial, everybody goes and flips these little electric teapots on, and there's this huge spike in electricity consumption. And so these guys, in addition to all the sophisticated data, they've got the local soap opera going on over here. And when that thing's heading for commercial, they're getting ready. They're firing off electricity. So it's a madcap affair. With just in a generic sense, when wind is on, of course, when it goes off, they need to replace that with something. And the same with solar or really any intermittent source of power. And it's so central dispatch in ERCOT. It's in a little town called Taylor, Texas. I'll be down there next week, and it's remote for security reasons and two great big giant facilities, and the British would let me in to watch their operation. The Texans won't let me in yet, but they have a complicated job of controlling supply and demand, because demand moves all over the place for lots of different reasons.
And the phrase you use to talk about the kind of electric generation that you're building in Texas and that you've built in England, what was that phrase again?
Well, we call it just generally reserve power. And so Texas is a little bit different, but we'll put a series of 10 megawatts, and it's size because that's the above 10 megawatts. You fall into a different regulatory category, and Rick Perry literally has to stamp your plan or something. It's really complicated. And below 10 megawatts are much easier to build. And so it's distributed generation is just their classification. Well, and
also,
so we put that in.
Yeah. Also, let me explain that under the system that we all operate in, the whole country operates now, the RTO ISO management system, what happens is people who own generation bid their generation in on a day-ahead basis. SPP, which is the RTO that manages this area.
Southwest Power Pool.
Southwest Power Pool.
And RTO.
And RTO is a regional transmission organization. They're taking on a new responsibility starting the 1st of March, where they will also dispatch generation. And the way they do that is the companies who own generation bid their generation in on a day-ahead basis, and then they do a calculation and they go with the lowest cost generation first and stack it until they can satisfy the need over a 24-hour period. That's probably too complicated to really get into, but essentially what I wanted to say was that in the case of renewables, what happens is they have to bid in just like a fossil generator does as well. And so if they bid, if they're a 100-megawatt facility and they normally can produce about 40 megawatts an hour, they bid 40 megawatts in, and as the wind blows harder, then they're advantaged. As it decreases, they're disadvantaged because they're producing less than the 40 megawatts they bid in. And somebody else has to supply that difference between the 30 megawatts they're producing and the 40 megawatts they bid. And so that normally will come from some sort of fossil-related generation. And that is very costly and very expensive to do that. And so that's one of the problems that has to be solved in the future, is to get a process that allows you to stabilize or firm up the wind generation.
If I could add to that, I know you're all probably going to move on, but there's a very interesting flip side to this. So because the chaos that's going on in Texas right now, and the fact that lights may flicker in either 2015 or 2019, who knows, compared to the relative stability that we have in Oklahoma, has a lot to do with economic activity too, because we turn no dirt. We hire very few people in Oklahoma. We build hardly any projects here. And so the the price that you pay for a monopoly-controlled, highly regulated system, which is slowly breaking down but still is highly regulated, is the lack of the economic activity. If you want to buy electricity in Texas, you've got 70 people you can ring up and call. If you're an industrial, you have proposals coming in the door all day long for every possible variation. And so we're in the reserve market. There's brokers of electricity. Texas is really the future. They're sorting it out now, and it looks chaotic, and the lights may flicker. But at the end of the day, the economic activity that is being generated there, the low, how do you maintain supply and keep the prices low? They're somehow winding their way through those debates, as painful as they are. And that's why their economy is – one of the reasons their economy is so much stronger than ours is they have that willingness to take this kind of risk to throw these markets into somewhat of a chaos. Out of chaos comes opportunity, and that's where we enter.
And the utility business in the U.S. has changed dramatically in the 20th century and into the 21st century. When electricity started, it was in large cities, and there was no electricity in the rural areas. And through REA and a variety of other rural electric electrification administration, and other governmental activities, it's grown and it's continued to change. And so that change is undergoing another set of changes, as the governor indicated, in the way electricity is actually marketed now, and as well as the way it's generated.
Well, that makes a perfect bridge, and let's kind of bring our discussion home to the future, and I think talk about something that probably everyone is interested in, and that is, what does energy generation and distribution here in the U.S. and around the world look like in 30 years? Is there room for renewables? Is there room for distributed generation? Does the world look like it does today in 30 years, or does it look different? And if you can see that it looks different somehow, what ways do you fellas think that it looks different?
Well, I would just give you one example. When wind energy began to be developed in Oklahoma, a windmill that was put out in western Oklahoma had a rated capacity of under a megawatt. And now they're putting three and a half megawatt units on the new windmills that are being built. And so there's technology and the evolution of whatever resource it is, whether it's wind or whether it's fossil fuels, is going to change things. We're going to see better transmission. We're going to see better distribution. We're going to see better appliances in your home. We've already seen, you know, a major change in the way appliances operate. And so all of those iterations of change drive business to decide what is the best way for me to continue to prosper and to continue to provide that kind of service.
My sense is that there will be technology changes in that span of time, of course, that we don't quite understand. I've been really surprised how fast battery storage. I've always kind of scoffed at whether there'd ever be economic battery storage at such a volume that you could do some of the reserve activities that we do. Getting 10 megawatts of battery storage to kick in is going to be a real trick, but that's coming on very rapidly. And so I suspect in 30 years, battery storage will be used as a big part of the reserve portfolio, which we're going to need because the transactions. I don't think utilities are going to go away, but I think they're much less of a player. You'll see a lot more distributed generation because of, you know, Lee's going to have self-generated power on his house if he didn't already. You don't really get paid for it in Oklahoma, but if he moves to Texas, he'll have a wind generator I was in the Pew Charitable Trust had a conference recently that I sat in on, participated in, and a guy pulls his phone out and he hits a green button. It's so simple to just make his home efficient. So it's You know, it and he has an electric hybrid car that soon, I'm not sure if it's now, but very soon, he'll be able to generate power into high peak periods out of his car, into his system, do a reverse meter in his home. So Texas is very close in some of these advanced markets to you being able to basically zero out your power costs by some production that you'll have at your home, whether it's solar or wind or some other form. You're going to have hydrogen cell technology, which has stumbled and fallen and got back up. And so there'll be technology changes. I think you're also going to see a globalization of fuel prices so that there's been such a variance in BTU cost, just the cost of energy. You know, one day natural gas is high, next day it's, Chesapeake, and everybody gets fracking underway, and now you can find gas everywhere, and it's low, and then cold winter, it's back high. You know, so you're all over the map. And we've had this difference between coal BTU cost and gas BTU cost, which has kept these coal plants going. Eventually, you're going to have that equalized. I hope they'll allow us to export out of the U.S. Natural gas, because that will help equalize the power costs around the world through a more and more efficient LNG terminal and distribution of great gas supplies into areas that don't have gas. And that's going to have a lot of power implications. I mean, among others, it'll advance a natural gas bridge to the future, whatever that is. And so I think that's there. I think you're just going to see a lot more transactional stuff. If our kids are as technologically adept as we anticipate they'll be sitting there on their there won't be iPhones then, I'm sure, but it'll be something controlling the power and their own power consumption and or their own power generation. But hopefully these regulatory barriers that hold folks like Oklahoma back, you know, because there's not a lot of creativity you can do here because of the regulatory aspects of it. Hopefully those structures will drop and economic activity will come in as a result.
And if I may have a follow-up question, you've both been very gracious with your time, and I know this is a broad question. I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but for our students, what could policymakers do, lawmakers do, to help foster the smoother transition to the future of energy?
Well, I think Lee's really the expert on that. That is the million-dollar question. What can you do without screwing things up
Absolutely.
Too badly? And Texas is pushing that envelope, I would say, among the ISOs that we operate in. But the ability for me to get connected with a small power plant in Texas is complicated. You know, but Public Utility Commission down there has now made it, which England did some time ago, is a very standard process. That utility can't arbitrarily keep me from being connected. My costs are going to be standardized. The process I go through is standardized. They can't sit on it for 6 months. They've got to respond within 30 days. And so those kinds of things to make this more efficient so that entrepreneurs who decide that, hey, if I have the right opportunity and want to put in and play these markets, I can at least get connected to the system, which has been one of the frailties here. There's been massive, beautiful, highly efficient power plants built in Oklahoma. They got shut in because of regulation while the coal plants are just belching it out, you know.
A great example of that is when Governor Walters was governor, we had a environmental management system in Oklahoma that was just fractionated. It was in six or seven different locations, and he proposed the consolidation of all of those environmental issues under one umbrella agency, the Department of Environmental Quality, and got that enacted. And that similar kind of thing probably needs to be done with a lot of the regulatory kinds of processes that we go through, taking the existing statutes, the existing regulations, et cetera, and modernizing them, if you will, to bring us all into the 21st century and allow the state and the country to take advantage of the opportunities that we have.
We called those days Camelot, didn't we?
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Right. We sang the song.
And Lee, incidentally, in 1992, was on that inaugural board. He's on this inaugural broadcast, but he was on that inaugural board for the Oklahoma Environmental Quality Commission and served on there for 18 years.
No, 12 years.
12 years. Was chairman in 2002, so he's led that effort. And I think we actually beat Texas to that because they now have a Texas Commission on Environmental Quality that is very efficient and has been, frankly, believe it or not, I mean, as a traditional power producer, they've been a delight to work with.
Well, that's wonderful. We may or may not have a question. Oh, we do have a question in. We have a question from Corey Ward, one of our Masters of Jurisprudence students. Corey asks, when Governor Walters says that in developing countries they should use anything that generates a megawatt hour, does this reflect that you support the stance that developing countries have a right to develop in the same pattern as developed countries over time, i.e. do they have a right to develop coal and dirtier products regardless of the environmental impacts that it may cause?
Yeah, I knew we'd get a reaction to that, but it's I guess you'd have to be there in the summer when the lights go out and your business shuts down and the folks can't make enough money to feed their kids. And, you know, it just is destroying the industry and the fabric of the society. People are frustrated, and so the extremists have a much better chokehold on the country as a result of all that. So my point is just keep the lights on. And if I got to burn sin coal, which is high sulfur, in an interim period to try to stabilize things, well, then let's do that. Let's put in a clean coal plant. Let's do all the latest technology. If you're running diesel, which you can't afford to do anywhere, but, you know, well, then catalysts aren't that expensive. So clean it up as best you can. But let's get it done as opposed to the very limited contribution that intermittent renewables are going to make at this point to the process. Now, do you do it? Do you talk about it? Do you encourage it? Of course. Because you're going to get lots of pressure from the developing nations to do that anyway. And so take advantage of that pressure. Take advantage of the grants and the loans that they give you on the renewables. But fundamentally, don't get so distracted by it because it's a 100-megawatt wind generator when you need 3,000 megawatts of natural gas-fired combined cycle generation, which you have the capacity to go do probably with at a fraction of the cost on a per kilowatt hour basis. So it's just, it sounds terrible for me to say, I know it, but it is a practical element of the choices that public policy leaders need to make to get after it.
Well, and I would add to that, Governor, that I think the whole question here revolves around really in large measure carbon emissions, CO2 mm-hmm. emissions into mm-hmm. the atmosphere. And there, the legal framework internationally is supplied by the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which provides as one of its elements that there is a common but differentiated responsibility between developed countries and developing and the least developed countries in order to deal with the questions of climate change. And furthermore, establishes that developing countries have a right to development. So I think the world agrees with you mm-hmm. Exactly in that the legal framework that has been established around the question in the context of the Framework Convention on Climate Change indicates really that the more developed countries like the United States, which is we're really probably the most profligate energy user in the world, maybe only second to China these days. They did exceed us in total mm-hmm. energy demand in the last few years, but I don't know if they're more profligate in their use of energy than we are.
But I think that's exactly the point, because when your feet are on the ground and your culture is developed and you have this riches of energy, which we have, and you have that luxury, then for us to turn our back on emissions and CO markets and all the rest of that is just reprehensible. So for the U.S. and for that matter China and others, everybody points to the U.S. The U.S. won't participate in these programs, won't really become a full partner in carbon emissions controls. And so just a terrible example that we're setting when we're the ones that could offset when those folks decide to burn send coal for the next 5 years until they get their feet on the ground. We can offset that with a blink of an eye with some rational CO emissions policies in the U.S. And that's the tragedy of the whole climate change thing being made an ideological wedge issue in the U.S., which is not the case worldwide. It's unbelievable in the U.K. Parties there fight back and forth, but boy, there's a common belief in saving the environment and reducing CO emissions, and it never is a. They just couldn't get by with their population wouldn't let them get by with saying anything different. Well, here we let them get by with making it a wedge issue, making it a partisan issue, and that's unfortunate. And until that changes, we're going to be setting a terrible example for the rest of the world.
I'd like to follow up in terms of when you're writing your thesis, there's no right or wrong side of the ledger to fall on. The key thing, though, for a good thesis is being sure you address both perspectives. And that's the key thing to think about if you do take a position that you're concerned about fossil fuel usage and development in developing countries. You have to do address the question of, well, how do they get power? When you're talking about countries that don't have the infrastructure that we have, and they just need to keep the lights on, and that's a real humanitarian issue. So do think about that when you're writing your thesis, no matter what side you're on.
Well, and let's ruminate on this if you would allow us just for a couple of minutes more. One of the other speakers that will be a part of this Answers in Energy program is an amazing woman, the Honorable Jessica Arroyo. And Jessica is the deputy director of the East African community, and her office is in Tanzania. And I met Jessica this last fall in Colorado at a conference, and I got a chance to talk to her. And there's all this discussion about 1.3 billion people in the world don't have access to electricity. 2.6 billion people cook on devices that cause enormous health consequences. And I asked her, I said, Jessica, when was the first time you got a light bulb? And she told me that the first time she ever read with a light bulb was when she went to the university. And it struck me at that moment, looking at this amazingly accomplished person who is one of the world's leaders, that the first time that she had ever read by the light of a bulb was past her primary education. It seems to me that when we think about the world that way, that you're exactly right, Governor, that these developing countries not only, I think, have a right, but along with that right have maybe an obligation to develop the resources for the people in those communities so that there can be the same opportunities for them that all of us enjoy. What do you think about that?
Well, I, as you were telling that story, I was thinking I was looking for a location for a power barge on the western coast of Nicaragua. This sounds like the beginning of an African adventure story, but it's so I'm wandering around.
A pith helmet.
I was literally by myself. I had a local guy with me, but we were wandering around and. There was a substation on the map that I couldn't find, and so I was walking through a dirt road village, and I finally found the substation, and I was taking lots of pictures because the substation was important how we were going to interconnect, and then I noticed there was people living inside the substation, inside the high-wired fence, so the standards required them to put a fence around it, but the local population determined that was just a security for themselves, so most of them moved inside there. And can you imagine raising a family around high-voltage equipment? Yeah. Oh, my God, it was just unbelievable. Well, a mother came out of there, and she was brushing herself off, and she was dragging her two kids, and I didn't know what to expect. She came up, and she was language deficient, so I couldn't quite tell, but she wanted me to take a picture of them. And amazing. She knew what a camera was, but it was clear to me, the local guy said she'd never had a picture of her kids. She didn't want the picture. She just wanted to be memorialized in a picture with her children. And so it just struck me as, oh, my God, never seeing a photo like that. And the same thing with never seeing a light bulb. And so the level of poverty, the level of kind of low quality of life that exists out there, the responsibilities we have as being the, you know, the so wealthy and so advanced and having such an abundance to deal with that. And I know our U.S. government does, and we offer, you know, they're ideologically driven in many cases and strategically driven, but it's we offer lots of programs and grants at very few other countries. China talks a big game, to be honest with you, in places like Pakistan, but doesn't provide nearly the level of resources that we do, and we get castigated for it all the time. But it is so inefficient compared to building the legal structural systems to make it work properly with private investment. You know, you hear about if you have $100 of grant money, only $10 actually makes it in the field. That was a number in Pakistan. Well, when you break that number down, half of the $90 that disappears in the U.S. before it ever gets out of here, because we're not set up to handle that. They hire consultants, and the reason Washington, D.C. is a vibrant economy is it's full of consultants, and so they bleed off so much of this money that the $10 billion, $7 billion African initiative and the UN initiative and all these other initiatives, you know, several billion of that's just going to stay right in Washington, D.C., and so it's very inefficient in terms of trying to promote it. We've got to get a handle on how we get money out in more of a WPA style that's much more efficient. The money goes straight to the needs of where it is, because we have a lot of money if we can figure out a way to spend it efficiently.
Well, and I think the point that you make is that you know, it's nice to do grants and it's nice to have business, but the absolutely, you know, necessary ingredient is stable law and stable government.
Exactly. We'd be building power plants right now in Pakistan but for the collapse of the contractual law. I mean, it just absolutely stopped infrastructure development in its tracks because they're totally dependent on foreign direct investment. And so that's a big deal. So your students ought to be excited that they've got an opportunity to restart all this development in so many places.
Absolutely. I think that you've both made some key comments on some very good topics that would make for great thesis.
Well, quite honestly, if I could, I'd keep you here all afternoon, and I'd ask you question after question until we wore you just flat slick, like our friend Kalen says. But I can't do that. I do want to say thank you so much. That we owe you both a great debt, and you have all of our gratitude. We couldn't be more excited. This inaugural part of our series has exceeded my hopes and expectations. I was absolutely right that if we would bring in somebody as successful as you, we'd start out successful ourselves.
Well, first of all, I just want to tell you all thank you. I'm honored to be here, and this is very creative, and congratulations to you for getting it off the ground, and I hope you have a great series of this, and I'm really delighted to be here with my friend Lee Payden, who is when I really need to know, you know, how the electrical system operates or the legal law work. Governor Bellman depended on him heavily during his U.S. Senate days for energy policy, and he's just he's a walking treasure. And I'm delighted to be here to share our joint views with you.
Thank you, Bill.
As am I. Thank you.
Thank you, Lee. Thank you, Governor.